Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Folks, December is almost here. It's hard to believe. The stores are full of Christmas and holiday stuff. And among the presents under your tree today is JPGN Journal Club, led by Dr. Jake Mann. But there's more than one present waiting for you. Go to the ESPGHAN Knowledge Center. That's www.espghan.org/knowledge-center. And take a look at what's available to you. On the 27th of this coming month, there's the MOOC Enteral Nutrition in Preterm Infants Conference. And then as we move into 2025, on the first day of the year, there's the Young ESPGHAN Mentorship Program. On the 15th of January, there's the GI Winter School. And on the 30th of January, there's a monothematic conference on steatotic liver disease in children. Well, that looks like a full plate. But there's more. There's Jake's choices for discussion today. From the Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition, Tesler et al. Present the association of human milk intake with outcomes in biliary atresia. And from Cell, by Jena et al., type 3 interferons induced pyroptosis in gut epithelial cells and impair mucosal repair. Jake, I made my way without too many problems through the biliary atresia paper, but I think we're going to have to go fundamental with a couple of explanations. For example, what is pyroptosis when it's at home? For the Cell paper, let's take it easy. Let's go with the biliary atresia paper.
Sounds like a good place to start. So this is a retrospective paper that is looking at the association between infants who were on any form of human milk, so babies who are having any form of breast milk prior to their Kasai, versus those who had no breast milk whatsoever and the formula-only group.
Just before the Kasai, or is it in the follow-up after? I had the impression that it was in the follow-up after as well.
The segregation of groups was based purely on their intake prior to Kasai.
Before Kasai, thank you.
And then there was no further difference, or there was no further distinction between the two groups in terms of their nutrition afterwards. In fact, I think their nutrition afterwards wasn't really discussed.
Okay.
And this was data from a prospective national cohort that the PROBE database, so it's a secondary analysis, but it, in theory it was a prospective cohort, which puts it higher than a true retrospective control in terms of our hierarchy of evidence. And the main question they were asking was, if an infant was on human milk prior to Kasai, does that affect their outcomes in biliary atresia? And the short answer is no, there was no difference in any of the hard endpoints in biliary atresia, by which we mean their primary outcome was clearance of jaundice, which they've just defined as a normal bilirubin at 3 months after Kasai, though I think typically we often would talk about it at 6 months after Kasai. And then they also looked at native liver survival, and again, there was no difference. They also had secondary outcomes, which were really related to nutrition, and there they found some subtle differences between the two groups. I suppose my main reflection on this is that it is very challenging in this kind of study to mitigate for confounding effects. If we look at the baseline demographic table comparing, they have a substantial number of individuals in this cohort, more than 200 in the any human milk group, and 200 in the formula-only group, I suppose the main thing that stands out to me is that it seems like the formula-only group had a later Kasai. So, for example, 13% of the human milk group had the Kasai at under 30 days, whereas only 5% of the formula-only group had a Kasai at 30 days. Now, we don't have p-values there to compare them, but knowing that that is the single biggest predictor of outcome and therefore probably will also influence their post-nest Kasai nutrition, I wonder whether that could have an effect on some of the subtle observations they've seen.
I don't know how you're going to tell them apart.
I agree. I think that the authors have done a very detailed analysis based on the data that they have. But almost all nutritional epidemiology type studies, whether in a rare disease focused cohort or in a large population, are very, very challenging to do. The authors have also gone and done an analysis of the stool microbiota in a subset of patients. However, that was only in 8 patients, which I think made it challenging to demonstrate any differences, even though I think we probably would assume that infants, if they had a very different nutritional intake, probably would have some differences in their microbiome, but they probably need more patients.
I'm not certain what to say about this study, except it struck me as possibly being dedicated to attacking a straw man. The idea that feeding with mother's milk might somehow be discouraged. And they wanted to investigate whether there was any reason for recommending the children be fed exclusively on formula. Did you take that impression away?
I think that is a clear message that comes across, that based on this evidence, there's essentially no difference, or there's certainly no reason to discourage infants having human milk, as they've just defined it here, rather than breast milk. I think that, as you're familiar, these are often individual patient-level decisions, and it depends on the nutritional status of the child, along with many other factors, as to whether they're recommended to go on to, for example, an MCT formula or not. And there is often something different about the children who are able to continue on breast milk post-Kasai versus those who you would recommend them to change.
Now we get back to the post and pre-Kasai business.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that maybe a sicker kid is considered to need more help and therefore is put on MCT. Which might explain, if the kid is doing well to start with, then that might explain why the kid grew a little better if receiving breast milk. But the growth measurements reflect largely post-Kasai growth, if I've got that right. And we're not told what the feeding patterns were after Kasai. All of the segregation, all of the discrimination, you tell us, was done before the Kasai was performed.
Yes.
This seems very muddled to me.
The bit that I'm not clear on is whether the interval between definition of pre-Kasai state, nutritional group, and when that was assessed and when the patient was first diagnosed or suspected to have biliary atresia and when their Kasai was done. So, for example, if it was a quick turnaround and they presented and then they had their Kasai within 4 or 5 days, then, for example, it's unlikely you would necessarily change over their feeding because it wouldn't make a big difference. The main thing is they'll have their Kasai and then you'll manage them afterwards. But what I'm not clear on is whether some of these infants presented substantially beforehand, perhaps to a smaller hospital, and then based on that, they had their feeding changed, and then that influenced their definition or which group they were in prior to coming to Kasai. For example, could that be why the formula-only group appeared to have later Kasai? Was it that they presented to a smaller hospital who then put them onto a formula or recommended formula because they were jaundiced, and then it was only down the line that they were then subsequently diagnosed with biliary atresia? And I think that things like that obviously have such a tiny effect on this overall data set that the only difference you see is a subtle change in mid-upper arm circumference, but it could influence these results.
Well, I guess we have to thank the authors for going through the motions for us. But once again, is the idea that children should not be given mother's milk a frequent among those who care for such children? Is there some, is it thought that mother's milk is just not calorically dense enough to do the kids any good?
I think that, at least in my experience where I've trained, that the major intervention is the Kasai, and if that is successful, then usually the infants will do well, because hopefully they're then able to absorb their long chain fats, so they can continue on whatever form of nutrition they were doing beforehand.
Gotcha.
That's okay. The main thing. The only other thing I was going to just point out was the authors do describe a difference in bilirubin. In some places, they've written it as a difference in total bilirubin, but in the table, it suggests it's actually only a difference in direct conjugated bilirubin. And the only difference is at 3 months post-Kasai, whereas then at 6 months post-Kasai, there is no difference between the two groups, which to me wouldn't necessarily seem to be a biologically relevant difference if it was only a one-time point.
Very well, then. It sounds as if we can all be a bit more intensely relaxed in approaching the question of nutrition formula versus mother's milk in children with biliary atresia before and after their Kasai.
Intensely relaxed is my default state, so let's stick with that.
Fair enough. You did your best to take me out of that state by suggesting the cell paper, Jake. I have to let you know, I am so pleased to learn that pyroptosis was invented after I went to medical school, which means it's entirely acceptable for me to have had to go and look it up, grumbling all the way, and to try to understand how apoptosis and pyroptosis differ. Apoptosis, if I've got it right, is a triggered process in which inflammation plays no part. Pyroptosis, on the other hand, is cells and their contents running screaming in all directions. Have I got that more or less correct?
Sounds bang on. Yes.
All right. So here we now have the matter of radiation enteritis and inflammatory bowel disease were both studied in a mouse model. And gut damage and repair in both conditions altered DNA configuration to yield Z nucleic acids. If any of you learned your English from an American, that's Z nucleic acids, which in combination with Z-DNA binding protein activate caspase 8. You in the back, pay attention. Caspase 8 cleaves gasdermin C. And the cleavage of gasdermin C triggers inflammatory cell death or pyroptosis. Oof. So, inflammatory bowel disease and radiation, gut damage and repair altered the DNA configuration to yield Z nucleic acids. Same sequence, just differently folded, differently twisted, which in combination with a specific binding protein activate caspase 8, which in turn activates gasdermin C, which triggers pyroptosis. And type 3 interferon induces the upregulation of ZDBP DNA binding protein, which promotes pyroptosis. My thought is then that the point of this article is to suggest that we have a new lever, we have a new fulcrum in modulating inflammatory bowel disease, because agents that alter type 3 interferon expression might lessen injury in radiation enteritis and in inflammatory bowel disease. Now, I'm not sure that I have the juice of that paper in this brief exposition. What do you think?
I think that that's the main message, really, that so far our main therapies for inflammatory bowel disease target cell-cell interactions and the recruitment of inflammatory cells and their secreted pro-inflammatory products, whereas this paper is really trying to nail down what is a fundamental pathway conserved across species that regulates the inflammatory cell death at the level of the enterocyte within the cells, and therefore potentially gives a new target and even new a concept of a target. I'm sure other people are working on other ones, but I thought this was an interesting point to bring up. I think the other thing that I guess grabbed my attention was, yes, pyroptosis, which I assumed you would have known much more about than me. But again, after a bit of reading, it is this inflammatory cell death, which I suppose the way I think about it is it's similar to how a virus induces cell death. Imagine a virus infecting a cell, an epithelial cell, it becoming packed with virus and then rupturing and spitting out viral contents. But in the absence of viral infection, now the analogy to viral infection is also probably helpful because of interferons. So I think that many people will probably be familiar with interferons in the sense of a antiviral response. So these are typically described as the type 1 interferons, alpha and beta, and they can be made by essentially any nucleated cell in response to viral infection, and that helps to enhance the antiviral response, for example, by upregulating HLA class 1. Type 3 interferons classically were described to do a similar thing, but very specifically in epithelial cells and particularly in the gut, which I suppose to me also kind of makes sense on the basis that we know the gut is a particularly important epithelial surface for protection against viral infections, specific enteric viral infections. But here the authors have identified that this pathway is harmful in the context of a variety of insults, and therefore, potentially, is it a pathway that could be modulated to reduce disease-related activity in inflammatory bowel disease?
Are you aware of any ways for us to get our hands on knocking down interferon-3 activity?
Well, the authors here have identified a whole... They've more or less mapped out the whole pathway, at least in detail, certainly in mice, and then shown that an analogous process happens in humans.
Humans, yes, yes.
So, in theory, almost any of them are targets. Now, you probably wouldn't target something like caspase 8 directly, I imagine, unless there was a way to specifically target it towards the gut, because it's such a fundamental component of the cell death pathway that if you were to get rid of it, then it probably would increase risk of malignancy. That is the risk of all of these pathways that are involved in mediating cell death.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But whether there was a way to just shift the balance over some of the regulators of interferon lambda production, the main interferon, type 3 interferon, then that may be an adjunct to other treatments in patients with IBD.
Are we looking towards some things that can be taken orally?
I suppose that would be one option, particularly if we're looking at enterocyte.
Exactly.
Treatment, you know, for example, like taking oral vancomycin, which shouldn't get across the enteric barrier and therefore only acts on the gut for treatment of C. diff.
Hmm. Well, where else do you see this particular observation going? Drug development, yes. Drug development and treatment, yes. Where else?
I suppose the other thing that comes out from these sorts of new concepts and new pathways is then, to what extent is this process playing a similar role in other tissues? So, for example, type 3 interferons have been described to play a role in the liver. Is this an important component of treatment? Or is this an important component of inflammatory liver disease, for example? Or in other tissues, is this axis, the sort of ZBP1, caspase 8 axis important, but with a different trigger? And this relatively novel type of work can lead on to those sorts of studies in other tissues.
Great, Jake. Thanks very much for making time to meet with us today. I've now learned quite a bit about pyroptosis, and how long I'll retain it is, of course, in God's hands. But thinking that I understand a little bit about it, a little bit better about it today than I did before, is, it makes me feel proud, happy, and smug. And smug is one of the finer emotions in my repertoire, I will tell you that. Thanks again.
Thanks, Alex.